Today's Teisho will be on Case 62 in the Blue Rock Collection. Case 62 is entitled Umon's One Treasure. Ango's introduction. With untaught wisdom, he engages in the subtle action of inaction. With unsolicited compassion, he becomes your true friend. With a single word, he kills you and saves you. In one move, he lets you go and holds you fast. Tell me, who is it that comes this way? See the following. Main subject, Umon said to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there is one treasure. It is hidden in the mountain form. You take the lantern entering the Buddha hall and take the temple gate, placing it above the lantern. Secho's verse, look on the ancient bank, who is that holding the fishing rod? Quietly moving clouds, boundless waters, the bright moon, the white flowers of the reeds, you see by yourself. Thank you very much for coming to practice Zen this morning on this beautiful, beautiful summer day. Summer is really here. It's not too hot yet, not too humid, and going outside to do keening was really, really wonderful. The university is bringing freshmen here in advance of the school year to get them ready for college. And they're probably all very excited about it. When we went outside, they were crossing the quad. And there was just this constant buzzing of conversation. And all these people excited about their future lives, talking to each other continuously. And we came out of the building, and we're quietly, silently going around a big circle. And, at first you could hear everybody talking and moving, shuffling. And then after a while, they were gone. Wherever they were going, they went there. And by the end of our walk, it was very quiet, almost, like deserted. Those are two moments in our walk. For a moment when we came out of the building, it might have felt a little awkward, We're doing something they might not understand, right? And it's difficult for people sometimes to do things that other people aren't doing. It's difficult to stand out in some way. It's difficult to be different, we're doing something a little strange. And, people might not understand what we're doing, and it might be awkward or embarrassing in some way. Actually, it's very good for those kids to see us walking silently, slowly, in a mindful way. They may never have seen anything like that in their life, and they may go home. And in the middle of the night, they might remember, oh yeah, what were those people doing out there? And they might not remember the event for years, and they might recall it later. They went to Rutgers, it was an in the corner of their mind somewhere, there are these people walking silently in a circle. Who knows, how that will resonate years later. Small things that we tuck away in corners of our mind can have a huge impact later on. It's good for them to see us doing this. It might be something unlike the way they live, very profoundly different from the way they live. And, basically for them to see this is at least to point to something like a different reality. You know, when we came out, it was noisy and maybe a little awkward. You know, when you are around people like that, you can feel uneasy. And you know, we're walking, we're focusing on the walk, on stepping forward. And, you know, those people become peripheral. They're not at the center of attention anymore, but they're there. It's like a little silent pressure. And then we keep walking, and, you know, you walk into shade, and it's very cool, very nice. And then you walk out into the sun, and there was a long stretch where we were out in the sun. And then we're back in the shade again. And gradually the noise abates, and we're in this quiet, we're in the quiet of the late morning. And we're walking through sun, and we're walking through shade. You know, we think there is one reality. But I actually don't think there is one reality. I think that's a very unrealistic proposition. Those kids are in a world very different from the world we're in right now, you know. They're making the transition from home to school. They're surrounded by maybe some peers, age peers, right? People are same age. They're all a little disoriented. You know, if you're away from home, maybe for the first time, you know, you're wondering about this adventure. You're chattering away. You know, what are you thinking about on the way here? You know, maybe you're thinking about, who knows? You know, but they're in an 18-year-old world, 18-year-old's world, and they have their own thoughts and they have their own reality. You know, their own reality. And we're in a different world. You know, really. You know, we're sitting in this room in the morning. It's dark, it's quiet, we're entering deep samadhi. You know, it's really not one reality. You know, when you're in a particular reality, it seems very compelling. You know, it seems very compelling. So, you know, when I started doing Zen, in 1976. So it's been a long time, and I went to University of Washington, and they had meditation on Wednesday nights, and I would go and sit, and I got very interested in this, and I eventually began to go to Sesshin. I would go to Sesshin, and at first Sesshin was just murder. It was absolutely murder, but eventually it became really liberating for me. I would feel really wonderful at Sesshin. Even though my legs hurt a lot, my mind would become very clear and open. And by the end of Sesshin, I was in a very different mental place than I usually was. You know, by the end of Sesshin, I felt so alive, and it was as though a lot of my barriers had dropped away. And my mind was just very still and open. And I would come back to my life, my regular life, and it was such a jolting transition, because, you know, the world, the everyday world I lived in was so different from Sesshin. And, you know, when you're in Sesshin, it becomes a whole complete world. You know, you get up at 4:30, you get into the Zendo, you know, and after like 3 or 4 days, this becomes very absorbing. You know, this becomes your world. Becomes the world. And at the end of, say, 7 days, you know, this world has become so all enclosing and so compelling and so real, you know, that it really seems like the whole universe, you know. And then you get in your car and you drive home, or in Seattle I would take the ferry and then take the bus to my house. And the next day, you know, it's very disorienting because everything is so different. You know, you're getting up at a different time. And your mental world is different too, you know. Suddenly, I had to get up early and get my work ready and get to my class and teach my class. And then I would go to my classes as a graduate student, and I'd be there'd be all these pressures, anxieties. And maybe I'd had to do a presentation, and I was anxious about my presentation. Not all the graduate students in my program were nice people. Some of them were my friends, and some of them weren't. Some of them were very aggressive. I remember a guy who I saw a few years ago, and in graduate school, he was very, very aggressive, you know. And later, I realized everybody didn't like him. But at the time, you know, when people would say things, he would sometimes, contradict them or take apart what they were saying. And I was very much afraid of him. So whenever I was speaking in this class, this particular class, I would always have a lot of anxiety that he was going to come after me. And he often did, you know, and then we'd have to fight it out. And always felt bad. And then, you know, I had other concerns, you know, money worries, you know. When I was in graduate school, there was never any money. I had a summer job when I was in graduate school, and I made some money, but my boss was a very eccentric guy. And he would give me these jobs that were very difficult, and sometimes I would screw them up, and he would get very upset. So, you know, graduate school was like one reality. It felt very compelling, you know. It involved being competitive. It involved being in this very intellectual environment. It involved working with students, being very disciplined, paying attention to details. The day became very, 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 very packed with things. It seemed like I could never get it all done. And, you know, that was such a different reality from Sesshin, you know. It's really the case, I think, that we think there's one world, but this is really a kind of a fantasy, you know. That, depending on where we are, we can live in very, very different worlds. Sesshin seems so open, so spacious after a while. You know, at first it's very difficult, but eventually there's just tremendous freedom, you know. Then you get back to your job or you get back to school, and that freedom seems to be gone. And there's other kinds of consolations. You know, there's the excitement of new ideas, or you're learning new skills. That can be very exciting, you know. But it's a different reality. And I think this is really, important to think about, that we don't really live in one world, you know. I was reading in the paper the other day this scientist, and he was saying that he said something that I actually agreed with to a point. He was talking about the fact that it's very difficult for scientists to NASA was trying to come up with protocols for identifying life on other planets, basically. And they got together some of the best scientists in the United States, and they all had them meet for like a conference and talk about when does something become alive, or how do you define life? And all of these scientists were like the experts in their field, biology, neuroscience, and they were trying to define life, and it absolutely went nowhere. They couldn't come up with a definition of life. And the conference didn't end with NASA creating the document that they were supposed to take around the universe and use to decide if something was alive or not. So this guy said, you know, actually he said, this debate over life, whether something is alive or not, trying to define life, is bound to fail because life is not real, he said. You know, and he said, if you look at how things interact on a molecular level or on a cellular level, it's very difficult to draw the line. He said many things that we think of as alive, like bacteria, really aren't alive because they don't meet the requirements. They can't reproduce, for example. And he said many things we define as alive actually don't exhibit any signs of life for long periods of time. So he talked about these very simple life forms that you are indistinguishable, say, from minerals, you know, for very long periods of time. And he said, you know, if you define life as being able to reproduce yourself, then crystals are alive, but we know they're not. And he went on and on, and he talked about how really life is he said, life isn't real, it's an abstract concept. It's an abstract concept. And then he said, really we live in a world of these mental constructs, and we create them, and they explain things, but, you know, they don't really, there is no there behind them. And I actually think that's, there's a great deal of truth to that, you know. The university, when I'm in at my job, you know, that becomes like this all-inclusive world. And it seems very compelling, and it creates all kinds of anxieties, you know. When I'm at Sesshin, very different world, you know. And we have this capacity, you know, to feel that where we, you know, to make where we are feel real to us, and it's compelling for other people too, you know. So, you know, you can talk to people about how unreal some of their responses are, but they feel real, they feel compelling. And we have this capacity to create this world around us that, as I say, seems totally real. This is both wonderful and it's terrible, really, you know. Because we can get trapped in these worlds that we create. We can get trapped in these worlds that we create. And they, because we have this capacity to make them feel so compelling and so real, you know, we can get to a place where we don't see any way out of where we are, you know. I was watching last night a movie that I saw maybe a couple of years ago, Blue Jasmine by Woody Allen. And the main character was somebody who discovered that her husband had been cheating on her, and destroyed her husband and destroyed their life together. And she was unable to get out of the life she had been living, the mental life she had been living. You know, she had been living this very, very privileged life, as supported by all this wealth that her husband had acquired. And this had become who she was. And then, you know, when this world fell apart, she was totally incapable of changing. You know, she couldn't get out of this world she had created for herself. And it caused her not only great suffering, but she eventually, one of the things that I found very moving about the movie was that she became really mentally ill. And I have known people who have gotten into this place where, get into a place where they don't see any way out because their reality has become so internally compelling, you know. And this happens to all of us, you know. I can remember times in my own life when, you know, it just seemed that I had reached a dead end and there was no way out. You know, we all have these experiences. Two people in my family have died of cancer. You know, cancer sort of runs in my family. And I remember, when my brother, my younger brother, developed bone cancer. He was only like 49 years old. And, I went to visit him, and he was already getting quite sick. And, I'm sure everybody has these moments where you just feel that you're in a situation which is totally unendurable or totally unpleasant. and that there's no way out, you know, no way out. And I had that same experience when I was taking care of my father. My father also died of cancer about 10 years before my brother. And it was very difficult to be with him because he was in so much pain. And it really got to me, you know, to see somebody I cared about be sick and in pain. My brother's wife lived through several years of his being very ill. And her life, you know, was utterly transformed by taking care of my brother. You know, their house sort of became like a hospital. And she actually became very depressed and had to take antidepressants because, you know, her world, she had been an executive. She's a chemical engineer, very talented person, and had this very high-powered life, a very beautiful life, really, very nice, you know. And then my brother got sick, and then her life changed radically. And every day she's getting up and taking care of this person who's really suffering. And, you know, we all get into these places where, you know, this seems to be reality. This is totally enclosing a world. You know, objectively speaking, we know that this is really not the case, you know, that we're in a particular world at one moment, but we all have moments where we can step out, you know. Even if you have a difficult job, you know, people manage to go on vacation. And if you get to on your vacation, you know, I can remember when I first came to Rutgers, you know, I had this very stressful job running this program I run. And for like 2 years, I didn't have a vacation. It was just so demanding. And then I finally went out into New Mexico with my wife, and we went up to a place called Bandelier Park, which is this beautiful park in New Mexico that has all these Indian, these Native American cave dwellings. And it's in this beautiful valley. And we camped out there and stayed there for a week. You know, and it was like having another, it was like another life. You know, I had been in this job, it was so demanding and so challenging, and I was stressed all the time. And I would get to work at like 8 in the morning and go home at 8 at night. And, you know, we flew out to New Mexico, and, you know, we stayed at Bandelier, and it was as though my life, my past life in Rutgers just disappeared, you know. It was just gone. And I remember, you know, we would get up and we would go up and in the morning, early morning, we'd walk through. You know, these people lived in this valley around 800 years ago. And they created these adobe houses in the cliffs. You know, and they grew corn and beans and they hunted animals, you know. And it's just this gorgeous, there's a stream that ran through it, which must have been the water they all depended on. And it's just so beautiful, and it was like another world, you know. I could imagine just living at Bandelier. I could imagine what it was like living in the Bandelier universe, you know. They have these places called kivas. They're round ritual centers, and you go. They're down in the earth, and you descend through the roof on a ladder, and inside it's dark, and there are these drawings on the walls, and. A different, you know, it must have been so compelling for them, right? Their world must have seemed like the total universe, you know. And when I was there, it seemed like complete, compelling universe. And then I was back. And, you know, when I was back at Rutgers, the Kiva, all of it was gone. It was like a dream. Did that even happen? Did I even go to New... You know, so objectively, we know that we have this capacity to create these mental worlds that seem totally all-inclusive, you know. And when we're at our job, it just seems the universe is our job. When we're in a difficult situation, when we're struggling with illness, the universe is ill, you know. The whole universe becomes our illness. You know, when we're with people, you know, it's the whole universe is the people we're with. We have this capacity, and we can get stuck because we have this capacity to create these worlds that feel complete. We can get stuck in our mental world very easily, you know. And people can feel, maybe we've all had this feeling, like there's no way out of this situation. There's no way out. I know my father very much had that when he was struggling with his cancer. You know, he became very depressed. You know, he tried to fight it, and then he got depressed. And he wasn't able to get out of that circle, you know. He wasn't able to see any larger horizon, you know. And I tried to cheer him up, but I just couldn't show him something else, you know. We all have this capacity to create worlds, and they can be very different, and when we're in them, they seem totally inclusive. This is how it is to be a human being, and you know, even some scientists think this is how it is. You know, that actually, we talk about life, living biological or organic life, but actually there's no such thing as organic. That's just a mental construct too. You know? And there are other examples of this as well. You know, I'm told, I never met him, but I'm told that during the Great Depression, my grandfather's brother, older brother, killed himself. You know, the stock market collapsed, the economy collapsed, and my older brother, was a businessman in New York, and he lost everything and killed himself. You know, that's very common, right? People feel that this is the end. You know, my world is over. You know? So. I think this is very important condition of being human. You know, we create these mental worlds. They seem compelling. They seem total in all directions. It's when you're at your job, it's your job in all directions. When you're in Bandelier, it's Bandelier in all directions. When you're at Sashin, it's Sashin in all directions. You know. So this is the human condition. You know, Buddhism actually recognizes this fact. You know. If you read sutras, they often talk about multiple worlds, and it's possible to think they're talking about maybe other universes, and they may be. But another way to think about it is that they're speaking psychologically about how, you know, if you go to France, you know, the people in France, if you've ever been to Paris, you know, they know they're the center of the world, you know. And somebody was just talking to me the other day about how arrogant the French are, even though I actually don't think they're that arrogant. But this person had been offended by Parisians and so on. But, you know, when you're in Paris, it is a very compelling world. And if you go down to D.C., unfortunately, that's a compelling world too, and all those people think that's the center of the world. So we can live in these different universes. You know, some of them are wonderful, are like paradises, you know, and some of them are like hell realms, and that's a fact, right? I mean, I have been on, one summer, I went back, when I got out of undergraduate school, I went backpacking in the Southwest, and it was like heaven, you know, exploring these mountains, no cares, I had saved some money. You know, I had very few wants. It was heaven. You know, 3 years later, I was sitting in a class, philosophy class, wanting to throw myself out the window because I couldn't figure out what Heidegger was talking about. You know, very compelling, right? So we have this capacity, and there are times when it's just, you know, taking care of, when I was with my brother, those were probably the most difficult moments in my whole life. Because I loved my brother so much, and there was nothing I could do to help him, and his world had become so dominant, his universe had just become cancer, you know, the cancer universe. And my universe became like that too when I was around him. I found it very difficult to be helpful. So this is the human condition. There's all these universes, all these multiple worlds. But you know, the Buddhist teaching is that in every one of these worlds, and some of them are like hell and some of them are like heaven, there's a Buddha, you know. So if you ever go to, countries in Southeast Asia, you know, like Sri Lanka, sometimes you'll see these rooms, and there'll be like 30 Buddhas in a row, and you'll see, and they're identical. Each Buddha is the same, and there's 30 of them. And you might think, well, why do we need 30 Buddhas? But the message is, see, that every universe has a Buddha in it. You know, no matter what the universe, even if it's like a hell realm, there's a Buddha in it. If you go to, say, like, I haven't been, but if you go to, Indonesia, and you go to see Borobudur, beautiful Buddhist sculpture there, you know, each level has a Buddha. Each level of the universe has a Buddha, and each universe has a Buddha. So, you know, what is this message all about? Well, you know, we've all gotten to these places where we don't want to be, you know, that seem utterly compelling and all-inclusive, all-enclosing, rather, and that are unbearable, you know. And some of them are just really difficult places to be. You know, one way to think about Zen training is that it's preparing you to find the Buddha in any universe where you wind up, you know. You know, we come here on a Saturday, and we sit down on the cushion, you know, basically we learn how to go through, you could say, the layers of your mind, you know. So you go through, you know, the top layer of your mind is worried about this project you're trying to complete. Maybe it's not going well, or maybe it's worried about your health, or maybe it's worried about somebody you love, you know. And then the next layer is like this layer that's almost dreamlike, right? It's these fragments of thought, this stream of consciousness, pieces going by, thoughts, memories, just flashes of memory. You know, you go down even deeper, and maybe you get to this place where there's this storehouse of memories and emotions. You know, sometimes you're sitting on the cushion, you're in this sort of you're moving up and down through the layers of the mind, and you can get to this place where you remember things that you'd forgotten for 20 years or 30 years. And they can be very emotionally resonant. You know, you get to this place. So, you know, Zen practice is, one way to think about Zen practice is that we're going through the layers of our mind. And this is the mind that creates these very compelling universes, you know. The reality of our world is really, the Buddhist view is fabricated by these mental processes. And the world is, what we call reality is, you know, that physicist who wrote that article and said that these are just concepts. I think he was right. You know, we have all of these sense inputs, you know, but the mind weaves them in very complicated ways. In fact, in the sutras, sometimes this is referred to as like a weaver taking these different threads of our perceptions and weaving it into a piece of cloth, you know. This is the cloth of our consciousness. And all this is happening a little bit below the threshold of our conscious awareness. But, you know, when we meditate, we're going down through the layers of the mind. And these are like this is all part of the production system for what we call reality. And we're going down through this production system. And topmost layer is the discriminating mind. And then there's this mind that's fragments of thoughts, stream of consciousness, memory. You know, at some time in your meditation, maybe not every time, but often, once, if you practice often, it will happen. At the end of your breath, you'll get to this place that's very still and dark. Very still and dark, you know. And in Zen, we call this mu or mu shin, empty mind. You know, and this is like this blankness is the door to the unconscious. You know, so when you're sitting on the cushion and you have mental activity like thoughts or memories or emotions, you know, you're going up and down, you could say, through the layers of the mind, and this is like the whole conscious mind, all these different aspects of the conscious mind. And every once in a while, if you're really watching your breath, you'll get to this place that's dark or blank or very, very still, very still. You know, the Zen view is that this is the limits of consciousness. This is the place where we're right at the door of the unconscious mind. You know, I have mentioned this before, but one of my second teacher's my second teacher was an art historian. And one of his favorite paintings, or actually it was a scroll, by a Japanese artist named Sesshu. He's a very famous Zen artist. And this is a scroll, so it's meant to be, you unroll it and it's like going on a little journey. So you unroll the scroll and it takes you through villages. You see a village and then you keep on rolling and then there's a stream and forest and some mountains. And up in the mountains there's a pavilion with people having a good time. And you know, then you go on in the scroll and there's a swamp with ducks flying, you know, out. And you eventually get to this place, this mountain, and at the foot of the mountain there are two monks sitting. And the mountain, they're sitting at the foot of this mountain and there's like a cave at the foot of the mountain. And if you look into the little door that Sesshu has drawn, you can see little stairs leading up the cave, right? Up the cave. Or through the cave, up the mountain, I should say. And in our temple in Seattle, we actually had a photo of that part of the scroll. It had been blown up and put on foam board, you know. And it was beautiful. These two monks sitting at this entryway to the mountain. It's a blank... it's a dark cave with some stairs going up. You know, that's such a good representation of the deeper part of meditation. You know, so, you know, we have this skill, this ability to meditate, and you go down through the layers of your mind and you get to this place which is blank and dark. And if you're a Zen student, you spend a lot of time right on the edge of the unconscious, between consciousness and the unconscious. Yeah. You just stay with that stillness. And if you stay with that stillness long enough, some really wonderful things will happen to you. Really wonderful things will happen to you. I'm not going to go into great detail about what will happen to you, because a lot of Zen training involves figuring this out for yourself or exploring this with your teacher. You know, most people get to this place maybe just a little bit during a sesshin. And if you keep practicing Zen, you can get to this place with great regularity. You know, part of the reason to go to this place is that this is like, this process of descending through the mind is a little bit like deconditioning. We create this reality that we think is very real and compelling. And, you know, a part of Zen training could be understood as like undoing that reality. You know, undoing, it's like in the sutras, it often says that human beings are like enchanters who enchant themselves, who like cast a spell, an illusion on themselves. It was one of my favorite sutras. It's called the Lankavatara Sutra, very important sutra for Zen. Says that these compelling worlds that we create, it says, are like, they're these, Indian mythology, there are creatures called Gandharvas. And Gandharvas are like elves, you know. they're supposed to live in the clouds. And it's very misty outside and rainy, when you look in the clouds, you can see all these mountains, all these hills. And the Indian people believed that when you looked at the clouds, you could see little castles or little houses in the clouds. And that's where the Gandharvas live. But of course, when the sun comes through, cuts through the mist or the clouds, all those beautiful castles disappear. So, our reality, our human realities are like this. They become so gripping, we can't believe they're not real. But one way to think about Zen training is that you're learning how to decondition, or you're learning how to free yourself from that enchantment. When we get stuck in life, when we're in these places where there's no way out, you know, intellectually, we know that's an illusion, right? We know that's not true. You know, people, I have known people who were contemplating suicide. I teach Zen. I meet people who have gone through crises in their life and have contemplated suicide. And, of course, they don't do it. And later, they're so happy. Their life gets better. They remarry. They have kids. Suddenly so much brighter, and they'll say, I'm so glad I almost killed myself. I can't believe it now, because life is so good, right? You know, we have this capacity to create these worlds that are so compelling that we can feel there's no way out. So, you know, one way to think about Zen meditation is that you're undoing the spell, you're undoing the enchantment, or you're deconditioning the mind, you're dismantling that reality. And a lot of Zen training is going to this blank place and allowing yourself to experience reality in a new way. You know, a lot of koan training is to go to this place, and then, you know, koans are often giving you subconscious or unconscious cues that are really like psychoactive substances. I'm really being serious. You know, koans are like these psychoactive substances, and you internalize them. And they produce like a gestalt switch, you know, really. You know, so many koans involve being, you know, put you in a place where you feel boxed in, and you can't figure it out. And then you go to this blank place, and the koan is internalized, and it produces like this gestalt switch. You know, and people routinely go through this process with feeling boxed in, depressed, unhappy, and they sit in this blankness and work with their koan. And you know, on day three or four of sesshin, people come in. When I remember doing my first sesshin, I had never done a sesshin before, and I had my teacher, second teacher, authorized me to teach, and then I didn't want to teach, and I didn't for almost a decade. But, I thought maybe I should give this a try, and so I did actually start this Zen group here, and we had our first sesshin. It was many, many, 19 years ago. So I was excited. You know, I got all these people to come to sesshin. We organized this thing, But then around day three, it was so interesting because people were coming into the Dokusan room and saying, people would come in to see me privately in Dokusan. And about day three, people were coming in and I was going, how is it going? Terrible. Horrible. You know, I'm having a horrible time. It's all I can do not to drive away. Please don't drive away. Keep hanging there. Next person, how's it going? Terrible. You know, people would cry. And I just thought, I went to bed that night and I thought, what am I doing wrong? You know, I am a total failure as a Zen teacher. I knew I shouldn't have gotten into this, you know. Okay. Next, 2 days later, right? People are coming into Dokusan and I'd say, how's it going? Wonderful. You know, it's fantastic. I can't believe this, you know. You're such a great teacher, right? And of course, I wasn't doing anything. It's a process, right? You know, so you go to this blank place and you stay there and you work with whatever, you know, there's real life koans too, right? So, I remember the phone call I got from my brother, and he called. He said, "Kurt, we've got to talk, you know." And he said, "I have cancer, you know." And you know, it was very difficult to you know, actually one of the first things I did was I went back to my cushion and I sat. You know, that became like my koan. My little brother is sick, you know. So you sit with that. You go to that blank place, and you know, for a long time, it's just darkness out there. It's just absolutely a nightmare world, right? You get in these places where you think, "Is this really? I can't believe this is reality." Right? And you know, you sit. If it's a big crisis, you have to sit in that blank place at the face of that cave, you know, at the edge of the mountain, for many, many sits. But you know, the Zen view is that in the mountain, our unconscious mind, you know, is enlightened. Basically, you could put it that way. The human beings are fundamentally enlightened, you know, and the unconscious mind, at the heart of the unconscious mind, is like Buddha nature, you could say. And you know, people have this extraordinary power to go, you know, to really have their life in ruins. And go to the mouth of this cave, and then, you know, everything comes back to life. It's like a desert, dead landscape suddenly coming back to life. It's like a gestalt switch. Or, you know, another way to put it is, we draw these little circles around ourselves, you know, and within those little circles we can get very unhappy. But, you know, when we go into that blankness, you know, it's like we draw a bigger circle. You know, or the circle opens up, and you realize it's a bigger world. You know, it's a bigger world. The boundaries of my life are not where I thought they were. They're much. Life is much more open, and this can even be, you know, this can even be the boundaries of the self. You know, we think we know who we are, but we really don't know. You know, and we speak about ourselves with authority, but we're constantly changing. You know, and tomorrow, who knows what will be? You know, when I was in Seattle for a while, I was Genki Roshi, my first teacher. I was his inji-san, or attendant, and my job was to take care of the Roshi. You know, and he was a lovely man, and he was pretty easy to make happy most of the time. Sometimes he would be upsetting, you know, but generally speaking, it was pretty easy to be his attendant. At one time, he had a friend of his come from Japan, and his friend was dying of cancer. This was another Roshi from Japan. He was staying at Genki Roshi's house, Kugeon. And, you know, there was an extra room, and he was staying in the extra room, and I guess they knew each other. I don't speak Japanese, so I couldn't be privy to their conversations. But, you know, this guy was sick, you know. He would have to go to sleep sometime, you know. But I was so amazed by his attitude, you know. He had this vibrancy, or... actually, like liveliness, really like liveliness, that it just blew me away. I've never forgotten it, you know. He was clearly dying, and he was happy. And I thought, how is that possible, you know, that somebody who's dying could be happy? You know, that just seems impossible. But he was clearly there, and it wasn't like pretend, you know. And I remember seeing him and my teacher in the kitchen, and they were making tempura or something, you know. And they had made a big mess, and they were laughing. And, you know, I'll remember that till I die. You know, it was just such an amazing thing. You know, and I think this teacher, and I can't remember his name, I'm sorry to say. You know, but I think he had practiced Zen very deeply and had gone to this place. You know, we get boxed in. We get trapped, and we go to this place, and suddenly it's a bigger world, and we're set free. You know, I think this is what Sesshin does, you know. And then we get trapped again, and we go to this place, this blank place, and we get set free again. You know, after a while, you realize, you know, it's never the end of the world. You know, life is very big. You know, the universe is very big. We have these little universes, but there's the real universe is beyond our understanding. But it's very big, and it's completely alive. And when you get into that blank place, you can get in touch with this energy, you know, like this indestructible life energy. And this man had done it, you know, and I've seen other people have done that too, you know, that were able to somehow get in touch with, get to this place and open themselves up. So, you know, Ulmon says to his monks, Ulmon said to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there is one treasure. You know, there's this place inside of us which is like infinitely regenerative, right? No matter how trapped we feel, if we go there, you know, it turns everything into a bigger life, bigger world, you know? And you know, the Buddhist teaching is that there's countless universes. In the sutras it says there are as many universes as there are grains of sand in the Ganges River, basically. And in every one of those universes there's a Buddha. You know, and the teaching, it means, you know, we in every one of these worlds we can occupy, including the hell realms, you know, there's a Buddha waiting to liberate us. You know, and your Buddha is waiting for you in your world right now to liberate you, you know. You have to go to him, right? You have to go to him, and he will help you. He's in yourself, you know. And the way we Zen people do this is to get on the cushion and quiet the mind and go to that blankness and then sit with that blankness and let it liberate us, let it set us free. In every universe there's a Buddha, and he's waiting to help us. And in your universe there's a Buddha, you need to go to him. Ulmon said to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there is one treasure. It is hidden in the mountain form. You take the lantern, entering the Buddha hall, and take the temple gate, placing it above the lantern. So basically, you need to do zazen. Secho's verse, look, on the ancient bank, who is that holding the fishing rod? Quietly moving clouds, boundless waters, the bright moon, the white flowers of the reeds, you see by yourself. Maybe that person who is at ease in the world, fishing by the river, is you. And you might not feel at ease in the world right this very moment, but that is waiting for you.